Welcome to our discussion segment on Body, Mind, and Soul. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Let's get started. John, I really enjoyed this podcast.
Very good.
It was a little bit of a departure from our political conversations.
Yes, and, I figured after a couple weeks. Yeah, I figured after a couple weeks of politics, it's nice to take a break from that. So no political content this week, folks.
Yeah.
Mainly because we're recording before the election, have no idea how it goes. How it went, I should say.
In hearing this podcast, the first question that came to mind was, our last couple of podcasts were about what's been called the Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. And the Renaissance ended those. I just have to ask, it's as if humanity woke up from being asleep in terms of, I know that they were creative during the time before this, and obviously there were works that were created during that time.
Yeah.
But it just seems like everything exponentially just kind of blossomed.
It did.
Why?
Boy, that is a long and complex question, because the Renaissance, as I said in the podcast, has multiple causes. One of them being the rediscovery of Greek and Roman texts, either found in archives that had been thought lost or brought back from the Near East after the Crusades. So there's that, and there's great wisdom in those works. There's volumes of science, mathematics, philosophy, much of which was far superior to what had been kind of discovered or what was common in medieval Europe. You also have the Crusades bringing about some medical advances, which I talked about in the podcast. And then there are two other factors that are not political in any way. One, the earth was getting warmer. There was a medieval warming period, which allowed more food to be grown, which allowed people to live healthier lives, which allowed them to live longer, which allowed them to have more children, and so the population begins to grow. That then feeds into the wealth of nations, because you have more people that you can collect taxes from. So nations become stronger and able to support a more diverse society than just the simple clergy, lords, serfs kind of structure that had existed in the Middle Ages. And then finally, the wealth brought back from the Crusades, as well as the more diverse economy, allowed a number of people across Europe who were in the peasant class to emerge from serfdom, to buy their freedom or to win their freedom in battle, or to buy their freedom with the wealth that they looted from the Near East and become what the Germans called Burgherrs, what the French called the bourgeoisie, and what the English called the people of the town. These were men and women who were not tied to the land, who had enough money that they could sustain themselves, and who thus didn't have to work the land in order to survive. They're able to take on a trade. Some became blacksmiths, others became coopers, some became artists, some became writers, some became poets. The idea of leisure time, which all but disappeared in the early phases in what we can truly call the Dark Ages, during the decline that followed the collapse of Rome. When the world got smaller, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, the world got smaller and the life of a peasant was just my home and my family, suddenly opens up again. And they can start to create products and works of art and sell them for money. They now have leisure time to pursue their own interests, which leads others to be able to enjoy those products. And then they become enriched. They start to be able to make money, because a farmer can, if his plow breaks, he can now get a new one from the local blacksmith instead of having to travel all the way to Paris. And now, you know, in earlier times, he wouldn't have been able to do that, or he wouldn't have had his lord's permission to do that. And so he becomes basically unemployed and probably starves to death because he can't feed his family. Now people are able to enrich themselves, enrich their communities, and to build a society that can sustain a much larger set of artisans who do produce a great deal of important work in the society, but are not producing what you would call like daily essentials. They're not producing food, or they're not protecting the town from neighboring or from roving bands or something like that.
On the topic of food and increased resources, do you believe that the plague had a hand in that?
That actually, well, yes. I mean, the warming period started before that. And so you do see the population start to rise before the plague. And then yes, it dips, which leaves more resources available for the survivors. So yes, it was a tragic fact that after a plague sweeps through and kills almost one quarter of humanity, there are going to be more resources available for those who are able to survive, bury their dead, and progress forward, as we talked about a couple weeks ago.
Sorry, folks,
I keep referencing podcasts of previous weeks, but hopefully you're listening to these because they're kind of building on a theme here.
Yeah. So in summary, you would say that the awakening that occurred was the result of many, many factors.
Yes,
it wasn't
absolutely.
Just one catalyst that suddenly changed and suddenly people are like, oh, I'm going to go read now.
Or No, most major change movements in society are the result of multiple factors. Simplistic documentaries will often say, oh, no, it was one thing that led to this complete transformation of an entire continent, an entire society or something like that. But no, you have to... You really have to look back all the way to the Carolingians of the 9th century to see the origins of the Renaissance, because they had the idea that education, universities, training people in daily life, but also training them to be scholars and learned men. That idea, though it doesn't survive the Viking raids and the crisis of the 14th century, becomes the inspiration for the new generation of Renaissance scholars in Italy, which is where the Renaissance began. They're looking back at what happened 5 centuries earlier and going, we can do that too. We have the resources. We have the knowledge, we have the desire, let's do it. And that then spread across Europe from Italy.
One of the things that stood out to me is obviously the renewed interest in information and gathering information. Where did the books go during the Dark Ages?
Yeah.
And how did they reappear?
A lot of them were burned. As we talked about in the Dark Ages episode a couple of weeks ago, people would find them. They would raid libraries in cities like Rome and Ravenna and Paris, and they would find these huge piles of paper. And they'd say, well, winter's coming. We're going to rip the pages out. We can't read this stuff. Maybe we see the pretty pictures, but if it's a choice between looking at a pretty picture and putting it on my wall or making sure that my family doesn't freeze to death, I'm going to use that as kindling to start a fire. I have read estimates that suggest that roughly 99% of Greco-Roman literature has been lost, and it was lost during that half century that was the downfall of Rome, late 5th, early 6th centuries. I kind of question whether it was that high, but it would explain why literary output, which is referenced in a lot of the histories written in Rome, doesn't match what we have today. If you read the history, the historical chronicles of the Roman Empire, especially the late Roman Empire, people are writing constantly. And yet then when you go to try and find whether it's poems or plays or early versions of novels, can't find them.
So it wasn't that all lost. So it wasn't that these books were in a basement somewhere.
No, some were. Okay. Some were. I mean, during the 11th century, the medieval scholastics, especially Anselm and St. Thomas Aquinas, do find huge treasure troves of books that had been preserved by local monks just kind of out in the middle of nowhere where there had really been very little contact outside of the monasteries. But most of the books were brought back into Europe either through trade with the with the Muslim world or as a result of the Crusades.
And that was the root of my question, because you have a renewed interest in gathering information. And to your point, most of the information had been destroyed.
Yeah.
So how were people able to satisfy this desire to acquire more knowledge?
It was either in the second or the third crusade. One of the ways to avoid having the crusaders sack your city was to turn over its library. And they would take those books back to Europe.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, as I said in the podcast, I mean, wars were fought over control of libraries in Florence, in Venice, and in a couple other northern Italian states. Not huge, massive wars, but you had bloodshed over the possession of a book.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it was almost a commodity.
Oh, it absolutely was, yeah. And to be clear, these are not printed books. These are handwritten, very, very valuable, especially if it was a Bible. It would have been expertly illuminated. There would be all kinds of drawings and illustrations of these images by professional artists who had spent their lives creating these things. So they were truly priceless works of art.
Okay.
It's not as simple as a textbook like what we have today.
Yeah. In the podcast, you reference the amount of information we can access now, and then you reference the disinformation that exists out there. And I think that there's always, I don't want to say yin-yang, but there's always that balance of information that's accurate and things that are inaccurate. Mm-hmm. How were the people of the Renaissance, and I'm talking about specifically at the beginning, and then going through it, how were the people at the beginning able to decipher the information they had access to now and that they had the desire to consume? The good information from what would be considered correct versus the incorrect information. How were they able to tell the difference? Mm-hmm. Were they just consuming all of it and they would decide later? Because you talked about the Socratic method and in terms of them reacquiring that skill, how did they basically understand what was good info and what was bad?
So you have to distinguish between the various humanities and the various academic disciplines. Math was the simplest because it's universal. It's based on numbers. And so they were able to look Sorry, I should back up just for a minute. Medieval knowledge was based really off of two books. You had the Bible, and then you had a book written in the early 5th century by a Spanish nobleman by the name of Isidore of Seville. He wrote a book called Etymologia, and it was the first encyclopedia. He creates a sum of human knowledge based on his understanding of the world, and not just his, but the colleagues who were helping him. They created an encyclopedia of everything from science to history, mathematics, biology, everything. Much of that stuff was completely inaccurate. So as Renaissance thinkers start to compare, they go back to the sources. They go ad fontes. So a mathematician looks at what Isidore wrote in the 5th century, and then they look at what Pythagoras wrote 1,000 years earlier. And then they start to do the figures, start to do math, and, right. and they figure out, okay, this is wrong, this is right. And they started to create basically commentaries on Etymologia and other works of knowledge from the Middle Ages. But they start writing commentaries. They start writing notes, correcting the errors. Science is based on observation. So Leonardo da Vinci, probably his greatest contribution to just general human knowledge was not his paintings like the Mona Lisa or something like that. It was his sketches of the human body.
Yeah.
Because he dissected personally over 30 cadavers. And he's like going through them with tweezers, trying to figure out where all of the organs, like what they lead to and how they work and all of that. And then he's looking at Etymologia and he's going, well, none of this is right. And so he starts making notes. And his notes that have been published, some of them quite recently, illuminate the errors of Etymologia. Same thing with like astronomers. And this gets later into as technology catches up with the Renaissance, when we get the scientific revolution in the 15th and especially the 16th century, where people start looking at the heavens and figuring out, okay, where is the Earth in relation to the rest of the cosmos? Or questions about how gravity works. Later on, once we get into the 19th century with evolutionary biology and things like that, they're all looking at earlier work and they're basing their corrections and their commentaries on new evidence that they have found, some of it good, some of it bad. The hardest thing to do is, or the hardest thing to correct is history, because all you have are various written accounts, some of them right, some of them wrong. And the greatest loss of the medieval period and of the various earlier cataclysms in human history has been the accounts of history. We as historians, we do the best we can with everything really from before anything before the Renaissance is it's not guesswork, but it's educated guesswork because we have so few firsthand accounts.
Yeah.
I mean, historically speaking, the Bible is one of the most accurate books of history that have existed. Whether you believe in its teachings about God and man and salvation and creation and all of that stuff, the history recorded in the Bible is backed up in more sources than anything else found in Greek or in Roman history, specifically talking about the West at this stage.
Yeah.
So you go as close to the source, as close to ad fontes as you can, and then you, again, I don't want to say we don't guess or anything like that, but we make inferences based on what we know, or we say this happened, then there was a period where there were political or social or cultural developments, and then it resulted in this over here. Well, what transpired from there to there, we do our best to guess. And good historians tell you, based on the lack of evidence, we're making an educated guess. We could be wrong, but here's what we think and here's why we think it.
So if you're reading Herodotus, you would look at other sources to either confirm or deny
his
claims.
Okay. Yeah, you would look at Thucydides. You would look at later historians like Polybius, and you would try to compare. Thucydides makes it very clear he's trying to write an objective book on the Peloponnesian War and on Greek history. Does he get everything right? Probably not. Archaeology has disproved some of what Thucydides wrote.
But he was trying.
Yeah.
Herodotus
is specifically trying to glorify Athens. And so he makes stuff up just out of nowhere in some of his writings.
So to summarize, the way that they were able to decipher between accurate information and inaccurate is by going to the source.
Yes, and by asking that question, why?
Yeah.
It's not about taking stuff on faith, which is what scholasticism does. Scholasticism starts with the premise of, here's what I believe in my heart to be true. Now let's make all of the evidence that I have found fit into that. Whereas Socratic and Renaissance thinking is, I know nothing. Let's see where the facts take me and where the evidence takes me. That was kind of a rambling answer. Did that answer
your... Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah. So in the age of information, do we use the same process? You hinted at that in the podcast.
We should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, basically what I just described is the scientific method. Good scientists, good historians, good mathematicians, good educators generally should take what they know to be true, not what they believe, but what they know to be true, but they should be willing to question it. Start with what you know and then work from there. But if your conclusions, if we someday discover that cell theory is 100% wrong and we are actually not made of cells, we're made up of thousands of tiny little robots that have been created by aliens, if that's what the data shows, not what we believe or what some religious group or some cult teaches, but what the data actually shows,
right,
we should be willing to accept that and to change our teachings and our beliefs about what we are. Now, to be clear, I don't think that we're a bunch of tiny nanites or anything like that.
Right, of course.
that was an off the
context example.
Yeah, that was an off the cuff example. Again, folks, Joe doesn't give me advanced knowledge of these questions, so I'm working. I'm thinking on my feet here.
Of the works that came out of this era, what, in your opinion, as a historian, when you look at the impact of this time period, had the biggest impact on the ages that followed?
It's verifiable. In terms of science and specifically biology, the Vitruvian Man and the notes of Da Vinci and the French surgeon Paré, those saved lives. And they've saved thousands, if not millions of lives in the subsequent few centuries. Now, they got stuff wrong, true, but the treatments that they developed, the knowledge that they gave to doctors and to surgeons allowed people to start to treat diseases that dramatically improved everyday life, which again was the goal of humanism. In terms of politics, it was Machiavelli's The Prince, which basically says whatever the prince needs to do in order to maintain his own power, regardless of ethics or morality or anything like that, he should do. That was a corruption of like the Christian values within Renaissance humanism. Machiavelli may have been a Christian, we don't really know, but his whole message is princes, leaders, don't worry about ethics and morals. What matters is you staying in power. In the area of art, it's really, I mean, it's again, Da Vinci. You've also got Botticelli, Michelangelo, many of these people who are depicting real life. Because art, for 1,000 years, was glorifying God and the church. Nothing wrong with that. But a lot of the imagery that comes out of those from the visual arts especially, but also from the written word, don't really depict what real life was like. We have a much better and much more accurate picture of daily life in the Renaissance than we have of the daily life of a average European during the Middle Ages. So if you compare like a mosaic of the life of a serf, you're going to look at it and go, okay, it's beautiful, but I don't understand a lot of what I'm seeing.
Right.
Whereas if you look at a painting by Botticelli, or you look at a sculpture by Da Vinci or Michelangelo, or you look at a wood carving by Dürer, you're there. You see exactly what that artist wanted you to see in terms of, well, this is the kind of home that they would live in, or this is the part of the city of Venice or Florence or Rome that they were living in. You get actual, like, well-defined facial features. Now, Da Vinci specifically, he was a bit of a rebel. He tended to blur the lines between the masculine and the feminine in a lot of his art, and there's all kinds of speculation about why, but some of his paintings are a little less accurate, but Botticelli and especially Michelangelo, they are very, very real to life. And they inspired the later romantics who are going to also try to capture real life with new techniques and new ways of creating art going forward. So there's different sure. levels of importance in terms of the impact that these arts have had.
Where did the tenets that you spoke about come from? Where did they originate?
From the writings of Petrarch. Okay. Petrarch,
How did he come to those conclusions? Why was it the mind, body, soul, and so on?
Part of it was the story of his ascent of Mount Ventoux, where he's thinking about this new, he's kind of depressed about what he's been taught by the scholastics, because he was educated in the scholastic manner in the early 14th centuries when he lived. And he, again, was a Christian, and he said there's nothing wrong with starting with the Bible, but in some ways that limits us. And he's looking around at some of the other artists in his area of northern Italy and southern France, and he's starting to see glimpses of people reaching out beyond what Scripture says, and maybe they'll do a painting of a landscape. Or maybe they'll see someone say, you know what, it's important for me to go to church, to be a good Christian, but I'm also going to set aside what God wills, being a serf, and I'm going to become a blacksmith. And he's going, is it possible that this new human-centered idea could actually have some legs here? And so he starts thinking about it, starts writing about it. He becomes a teacher. He teaches his students about this. And his students are some of the very first Renaissance men. These people who are self-made, who are self-taught in various artistic forms, who are knowledgeable about science and math and art and history and all of that. All of it comes from his letters and from his experience living at the transformation, seeing all of this new wealth and all of this new knowledge coming in from the East, seeing money coming in from the wealthier states of France and the Holy Roman Empire. And he was just kind of at the right place at the right time, and he developed this worldview. He's not the only one, but he is widely credited as being the father of humanism because he's the first one who put pen to paper.
Okay. How about if we talk about St. Thomas Aquinas a little bit?
Okay.
In terms of scholasticism, he was obviously a proponent of that.
Oh, right? Yeah. He's the biggest proponent of it.
Was there, once there was a divergence from that, I don't know, like call it ideology.
It's more pedagogy. It's a method of teaching.
Yeah. So from there, when that divergence happened, didn't Renaissance men look back on what St. Thomas Aquinas wrote and find any value in it?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Less so of some of the other scholastics who tried to, like medieval scholastics who wrote on science or who wrote on astronomy. There was a lot of criticism of those. But Aquinas and the Summa Theologica, he kind of stayed in his lane. Scholasticism absolutely works. It is still used today when you're talking about theological topics. And that's what the Summa Theologica was. I mean, it's in the title. It's a summary of theology. So
how long is that, by the way?
The full version, which is unfinished, is, I think, 6,000, 7,000 pages. It's huge. It's huge. If you are interested in it, there's a book called The Summa of the Summa. It's written by Dr. Peter Kraft, who is a wonderful Catholic philosopher, someone I've listened to for years. He's fantastic. I would recommend that book. It's only, I think, 300 pages, which is nice. But there's a reason why St. Thomas Aquinas is still revered as one of the senior doctors of the church. It's because he got so much right in terms of theology, in terms of moral philosophy. The book is interesting because it follows what you might call the rule of three, in that with every theological topic, there are always three points of proof, two from scripture and one from the natural world, or vice versa, one from scripture and two from the natural world. And there are always the top three objections made by the heretics, and he refutes each one of them with three different counter arguments. So it's three within three within three, wheels within wheels. But unlike so many of the other medieval scholastics, Aquinas is still considered one of the standard works of moral philosophy and Christian writing. So what new hobby are you going to take up, just to kind of start to close this out after being inspired by my episode? How are you going to enrich body, mind, and soul in these days?
That's a great thing.
Actually have been. You took up something.
Yeah, the rucksack. Purchased a Go Ruck back in March.
They're not paying us for that. Love them.
They're not, but it's an outstanding backpack. FYI, Go Ruck, if you would like to sponsor this podcast.
Yes.
So I did that. I'm always trying to find that next thing. So it's always, I know that as one gets older, it's a little bit harder to go on a jog, especially when, like me, I weigh more than I should. Puts a lot of stress on my joints.
You're also old.
Yeah. Yeah. Proudly, I wear it as a crown. And so,
although you have more hair than I do,
the rucksack was a great low impact way to exercise and also hear audiobooks on Audible. So, yeah, I mean, that, and I think in general, you know, as you get older, you start to try and center on those things that you know that you enjoy and that you have some talent in. And based on what others have told me, you know, I have some talent in my day job and also in how I write. And so, how can I master those two things extremely well? And so, at some point, I would love to learn an instrument. But it's just a combination of all of those things taken together and always being in the search of that new thing. And you?
The big one was cooking, but I've also been reading more, especially since the start of the new school year. I don't know why, but it seems like I have more free time on my hands. So I've been trying to find good books, audiobooks on Audible, and just kind of widening my perspective, my lens, reading a lot of Enlightenment writers and Enlightenment philosophy and things like that, just stuff that I had heard about and read about in college, but I'd never gone to the source. And so I'm trying to do more with that. And then, cooking fun stuff for some of my students to try.
Yeah. So in the podcast, you talked about Foie gras?
Foie gras, yes.
Yeah, what is that?
The French meal. It's either goose or duck liver, and it's really hard to find stuff that you can that's imported from France, but I managed to come across some, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to make this and give it to my students, and they loved it. We were studying Napoleon, and I did a little, basically a little meal. Napoleon believed in small meals spaced out throughout the day. He would have one large meal at the end of the day, but when he's out on campaign, he's just real quick, get a quick shot of energy. So I put together just a small Marshall's meal and served it to the students. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this was so good. And I told them what was in it. Ah, liver! A couple of them were perfectly fine. I did get one parent complaint, but you know.
It happens.
And I made sure that there were no food allergies or anything like that. I didn't force the kids to eat it. I was like, if you want to try it, you're welcome to, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. And so right there, like four kids, like, nope, I'm out.
Yeah.
But that was a fun memory.
In closing, when I was hearing the podcast, it was one of those things where the philosophy that was purported by these men has no downside. It doesn't seem like there's...
As long as you keep the religious component, because...
Yeah.
Humanism without religion has been kind of dangerous.
But in terms of specifically the body, mind, and soul, like how do we build those things up? It's an interesting also to think about the going to the source.
Mm-hmm.
When I hear something on the news, regardless of the channel, how do I view?
Careful, we promise no politics in this.
Well, no, I'm just saying, like, if I hear something on the news or on Reddit or on social or whatever else. We have the
Or even on a podcast.
Right.
Or in a classroom. Podcast. Yeah. You know? Don't take what we say for granted.
Right.
Do your reading.
You have the tools available to go to the source.
Yeah.
So deciding for yourself and really taking that point of action and saying, I'm going to go to the source and decide on my own if I agree or not agree.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in hearing the podcast, that was a huge thing for me, because even though, you know, this time period was long ago, and it was, as I said at the beginning, it seemed like a slumber ended, like humanity woke up again, and we started to embrace things that do bring joy and do make us stronger as humans. Even though that happened a long time ago, the tenets are still valuable, and the application of those today seem to be more important than ever with this abundance of information.
Yeah.
Is that something that you would agree with?
Oh, absolutely. Or
is there anything to add on
to
that?
No, I think that's absolutely true. All I would say is to exhort, just as you were saying, you know, it's about trying to streamline your processing of information, go to the source, whether you're reading about science, history, whatever it is, even the dreaded P word, politics. Don't just trust the first thing you find, because very often the first thing that you find, especially on the internet, is it's the first thing for a reason. And that reason could be accuracy, but it could also be bias and agenda.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of Body, Mind, and Soul. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. Thank you, and see you all next week.